Good morning to the court. My name is Dan Delaney, 35958, appearing on behalf of the appellant Multi Associates. This case finds its genesis in 2005, approximately. It has been through one trial court proceeding involving the validity of the underlying debt, a court of appeals proceeding, challenging that particular ruling, and now a second trial on the claims asserted by Multi of fraudulent transfer and the violation of the limited fiduciary duty announced in Anstine. Sort of the fundamental proposition that I'd like to suggest that the court colors its analysis throughout is how we have to evaluate the facts and circumstances that were presented to the trial court. And that evaluation, I think almost without question, has to occur from the perspective of Multi, the creditor, who is asserting that the transfer was in fact fraudulent. In reviewing the briefs, I think I probably told you that too many times, but nevertheless, I think it influences strongly what the trial court was supposed to do when on de novo review in this court, what this division is supposed to do when it looks at these particular facts. The purpose of Colorado's fraudulent transfer statutes is to protect creditors. It is not to somehow provide a vehicle for the diversion of funds to officers of insolvent corporations. It's not designed to give shelter to people who are clever enough to structure their businesses, structure the entities to do those businesses in a way that makes it difficult for creditors left holding the bag at the end of the day to reach in and get some, get some funds. Another overarching concern is, or concept is that the goal is to preserve assets for the benefit of the creditors. The goal is to make sure that at the end of the day, there's something there for the creditors. Certainly there's no guarantee that there's going to be something there for the creditors, but when you're evaluating these statutes, when you're evaluating these cases, it's to be with an eye towards preserving assets for the benefit of creditors. There are a few legal concepts that recur in the context of fraudulent transfer statutes. I'll go through them in no particular order, starting first with insolvency. Judge Furman, I think you authored the paratransit case, so the concept of corporate insolvency is something that you've worked with quite extensively, and I think that case is informative. To some extent, though it does deal with a different context. But insolvency, for purposes of the Colorado Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, occurs in essentially two contexts. One, when there is balance sheet insolvency, and two, when a company is not paying its bills as they become due. In the interest of killing two birds with one stone, insolvency is a concept that comes up in the context of our appeal. There is also a basis cross appeal that's been filed in this case. So it's of particular importance. Balance sheet insolvency is just that. You look at the balance sheet and assets are less than liabilities. This was the case with respect to Zephyr Development, its entire existence. I think that the trial court classified it as operating in a state of perpetual insolvency in its opinion. And I think that's accurate. I think that the purpose of Zephyr was to be a clearinghouse for expenses. I don't pretend to be a tax person. I don't know what the nuances or benefits of doing it in that way are, but nevertheless, that's why it was there, to be a clearinghouse for expenses. The testimony at trial, which is amply reflected in the record, was that Zephyr never operated with an intent to make a profit. Never operated with the ordinary motivations that businesses have. That analysis is, I think, particularly important in the context of the second sort of insolvency, which is whether or not a business is paying its bills when it comes due, whether it's operating in the regular course of business. I think that Judge Furman classified it as the equity insolvency test, and I believe that's what I called it in the context of the trial court. That equity insolvency test contemplates that the corporation is operating in good faith and it's operating with an intent to go out and make money. That really wasn't what Zephyr did, and it certainly didn't do that after the home run of the Madison project. The Madison project netted a tremendous amount of money, at least by my lights, several million dollars, for the benefit of Madison Orchards, an entity that is not really the subject of this case, at least when it comes to the analysis of insolvency. The money that the Madison Orchards project netted did not go into Zephyr's bank account. There's no dispute about that. That money went to a separate entity, and when it came time to pay Mr. Kaler's bonus, some other entity, Zephyr Holdings, took money from one of its accounts and gave it to Zephyr Development for the sole purpose of paying that particular bonus.
Counsel, let me just ask a fundamental question here, because you're going over a lot of facts. To what degree is discretion at issue here?
I think it is definitely at issue. I think the court has to...
So if the court found that practically it was not insolvent, or there was no reason to suggest that, that's just a factual question, isn't it?
Well, in this particular case, the trial court found that the company was insolvent.
Okay, but at what point?
At all times relevant. As I said earlier, the trial court found that from its inception, Zephyr operated in a state of perpetual insolvency. Yes, there's a tremendous amount of discretion that goes into that analysis.
And how did Zephyr collect money in order to pay the bills?
In an extremely haphazard way.
Okay, but how?
It didn't send out bills, typically. Ordinarily, a company that's providing services to other companies would prepare an invoice and send it out. Doesn't do that. Essentially, it operated at the whim of Mr. Schoninger, the individual who owned Zephyr Development, several other
companies. And Mr. Schoninger would then submit money to the company to pay the bills?
As he saw fit. Because it didn't generate money on its own. Because
right.
It didn't go out there and act like a regular business and make money. That's why he had to do that. And that information, I think, was well known to Mr. Kaler, which sort of dovetails with any number of other elements in this particular case. Another important aspect...
Well, if that was well known, why is that not an important fact, then?
I think it is an important fact. I think the fact that Zephyr relied upon loans constantly as its essentially sole source of income is an important fact, and I think goes to an analysis of whether or not this company is insolvent. But Judge, I would suggest that the insolvency analysis, it's an either-or proposition. If it is balance sheet insolvent, or if it is not paying its bills in the ordinary course. Either of those two definitions of insolvency satisfies the insolvency test in the context of the Colorado Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. The court in this case found that it was insolvent under both analyses, and Mr. Kaler is challenging that particular assertion on cross-appeal. I think all of the credible evidence that was adduced at trial would indicate that insolvency, in fact, existed.
If they paid the bills, if all the bills have been paid off, isn't there a zero balance? No assets, no bills, no liabilities out there?
No, sir, because of the way in which it took that money. What, in fact, Zephyr did was run a loan with another Schoninger-owned entity. And in fact, by the sort of tail end of all of the relevant times that we're talking about, it had a $1.5 million net balance, negative net balance. It was losing money. If you look at the papers that we filed in the brief, it was losing money to the tune of between, if memory serves, $75,000 a year on up to $1 million-something a year by the year.
Did it show that negative balance at the time Mr. Kaler received his payment?
Absolutely, Your Honor. There, the testimony at trial was uncontested about the fact that had Mr. Kaler cared to do so, he could have looked at the balance sheet as it existed at the time and found that the company was balance sheet insolvent. His own expert, when pushed, testified to that fact. His own expert at trial was there to try and convince the trial court that what we needed to do was throw out the books as they existed at the time of Mr. Taylor's departure, and instead rewrite them as we would like them to be now.
When Madison Orchards, when that closed, there was a value for the service, was there not?
There could have been a value for the service.
So isn't that what the court found?
I think that the court did find that there was a value for the service, but the problem with that is that the testimony at trial was uncontested that Zephyr didn't track that in any way. And let's talk about the payments that we're talking about, Judge, just to be clear. Mr. Taylor was paid a salary of $135,000, and then he got bonuses in about $540,000. We are not challenging the salaries. What we're challenging is the bonuses. The bonuses were not tied in any way to Mr. Kaler's work. If he had worked one hour.
But wasn't the bonus tied to the Madison Orchards project?
It was tied purely to the closing of that project.
And that was really the focus of Mr. Kaler's work, was it not?
Almost entirely. I would argue, Judge, that he did nothing for Zephyr itself and did everything for Madison.
And weren't those bonuses part of his employment agreement?
They were. They absolutely were.
And that's not reasonable in your mind?
That's not the question, whether that number is reasonable. The question is whether or not, from the perspective of a creditor, there was reasonably equivalent value transferred to Zephyr by Mr. Kaler in exchange for that $500,000 plus bonus. And based upon the question that the court just asked, where did the benefits accrue? I think the only answer is the benefits accrued to Madison. Contrary to the court's ruling, where it said that the project netted $5 million or $7 million for the debtor being Zephyr, it didn't. It netted that money for an entirely different, separate, and distinct entity, never went into Zephyr's bank account. The value has to be evaluated pursuant to the cases cited in the brief from a perspective of their utility to a creditor in this particular context. The utility to the creditor is the touchstone. As the Texas court that I cited in the brief said, if you look to the transferee, if you will, in this case, Mr. Kaler, or to the transferor for evidence of reasonableness or value, of course they're going to rationalize some sort of value or reasonableness. That's why you throw their opinions out and you look only at what the utility is from the perspective of the creditor. I'm going to try and save 2 minutes, but if you look at the order that the court issued below, you will not find any indication that the court applied the proper perspective. The hallmark of this argument is the court has to look at it from our side, not from theirs. And all indications are that they looked at it only from the side of Zephyr, Mr. Kaler. And that's inappropriate as a fundamental proposition. I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
You have a minute and 45.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Jack Donnelly, registration number 17119. I represent Lynn Kaler, the appellee, and the cross appellant in this matter. This case has to do with a disappointed creditor trying to force the past employee of a defunct corporation to pay that corporation's debt. And that's not something that's generally permitted by the courts. The courts and the laws of the state of Colorado protect employees and protect shareholders. And it's only in very exceptional cases that an employee, particularly an officer, director, or a shareholder is going to have to pay those corporate debts. And the exceptions in this case that the Nolte is claiming are the Fraudulent Transfer Act and the breach of fiduciary duty act claim. And the elements simply don't fit in this case. And the point of the whole argument is that there is nothing that Zephyr did, Mr. Schoniger did, or Mr. Kaler did in this transaction, this transfer of a wage to Mr. Kaler, that had any impact or caused Nolte not to get paid.
Aren't you though to succeed here hoping that will blur the distinctions between Schoniger, his entities, and Zephyr? Isn't the real question, or at least the receipt of the reasonable value, What did Zephyr get? And what did Zephyr give? Two questions I ask. Well, it seems to me is that, seems to me is first, isn't the question only what Zephyr got from Mr. Kaler and what Zephyr gave to Kaler? Zephyr gave $540,000. What value did Zephyr get as opposed to some third-party entity?
Your Honor, I think that's exactly the question. Mr. Kaler had a contract with Zephyr whereby Kaler would work for Zephyr and Zephyr would pay Mr. Kaler. Zephyr had a deal with Madison Orchards, whereas Zephyr would work for Madison and would provide that work, and its employees would do that work. And when we talk about this viewpoint from the creditors, Mr. Kaler had a valid, enforceable claim against Zephyr for $540,000 the second match at Madison Orchards closed. And therefore, when Zephyr paid Mr. Kaler, it released a debt of $540,000. And in any corporate world in the consulting business, just like Nolte hires employees to go do consulting work for other corporations. And those employees are actually working on somebody else's business. Nolte's employees were over working on Madison's business. They were working on doing survey work. However, they want to be paid by Nolte when they're done. Their salary comes from Nolte. And it's Nolte that did the contracting work for Madison, not the employees. And it's the same way with Zephyr. Zephyr was contracted with Madison to do Madison's work. Its employees did that work. Mr. Kaler, however, was an employee of Zephyr and had a contract with Zephyr. He was entitled to be paid. And so the reasonably equivalent value was Zephyr owed Mr. Kaler $540,000 pursuant to a valid, reasonable contract. And Zephyr paid that contract. Kaler kept his part of the bargain. He gave consideration. That's reasonably equivalent value.
Doesn't that formulation, though, almost always automatically give the company an out when they otherwise didn't have any money to pay anybody else? Doesn't it almost automatically? Well, I own my employees. My employees come first, so I pay my employees. Creditors, tough luck for you.
Well, I think employees have a valid claim against an employer, and that's the idea of reasonably equivalent value. That's one of the elements of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, is it's not a fraudulent transfer if the person who receives the benefit has given reasonably equivalent value. And that's that viewpoint of the creditors. The net value of Zephyr did not change by the payment to Mr. Kaler. So if I'm insolvent and I give my house to you and don't receive anything back, then I've lost that asset out of my business or out of my estate. Whereas if I sell that to you for a reasonable value, nothing changes. You may now have the house that's worth $200,000, but I have $200,000 in cash. In this instance, it was a liability. And that was a valid liability that was released in exchange for that payment.
Well, you're using it. What is the valid, what are you referring to when you say it? The payment?
The payment of Mr. Kaler's wage was a valid liability owed by Zephyr to Mr. Kaler. And Mr. Kaler would have been a competing creditor with Nolte in the years later if he hadn't been paid. But he had a valid enforceable claim. Zephyr had a liability it had to pay. They exchanged those for that payment. And it didn't have any impact on the value or the balance sheet of Zephyr.
Okay.
As an equal value.
In your house example, though, if you sell the house, then the money you get from the house goes back into the company. But here, what money came into Zephyr that Kaler's value brought?
It wasn't, well, I have two answers to that question. One is, money did come in. Money came in from Madison Orchards to pay Mr. Kaler's debt. But the more important question is it wasn't money coming in, it was value defined under the statute as payment of a debt. And it was, that's that, can't give you the citation on it. That's CRS. $38,8104 value. A transfer is made for present value if the exchange between the debtor and the transferee is intended by them to be contemporaneous, as in fact substantially contemporaneous. The point being is that Mr. Kaler gave value by releasing his liability. And so that was a neutral impact on the value of, or on the balance of Zephyr. So when he released the debt, that liability came off of their balance sheet. So it remained, the profit down at the bottom with a negative number at the bottom was exactly the same when he left. And the fact is that money did come in from Madison. Madison paid for his services. Now the fact that Mr. Schoniger chose to classify that as a debt was a business decision he made. And frankly, if he tried to enforce that debt against Nolte in the years to come, that would have been an antecedent debt that would have been avoidable. Mr. Schoniger could have never paid himself that liability or that note payable in the face of Nolte's claim. What's important again here is that there is nothing that Mr. Kaler did, Schoniger did, or Zephyr did, or Madison, or anybody, in regard to this transaction that caused Nolte to not be paid. As we deal with the, I think that, you know, Harry Truman once said, if you can't convince them, confuse them. And when we talk about insolvency from the creditor's perspective, and we talk about this concept that Mr. Kaler was really working for Madison Orchards and not for Zephyr, and we start talking about whether or not every badge of fraud was found, and we talk about antecedent debt, that's confusing. That's just added confusion that's inconsistent with the laws of the state of Colorado, the Fraudulent Transfer Act, and this breach of fiduciary duty claim. There's no causal relationship. Mr. Kaler never had the ability to pay the Nolte debt, absent writing the check himself, and he never did anything that caused that. As we talk about the antecedent debt argument, where there's a claim that this was somehow an antecedent debt, the statute defines the fact of what present value is. And these two entities, Zephyr and Kaler, they had a deal whereby he was going to get paid at the closing of the Madison deal. And he left $5 million in the bank with Madison, or $4.5 million, and he accepted payment within several weeks of that transaction occurring. That's a contemporaneous debt. That's not the kind of debt that the Fraudulent Transfer Act is trying to avoid. Indeed, there are two citations, Your Honor, that I didn't point out in my brief that I think are important here for you under the Fraudulent Transfer Statute. And that's CRS 38-8-1096. And that provides a complete defense to this antecedent debt claim so long as the transfer was made in the regular business and financial dealings of these two parties.
Now, is that in your brief?
It is not, Your Honor. I didn't cite that. It's in the Fraudulent Transfer Statute. And the other statute also is 38-8-110 (1C) in the antecedent debt claim, and that is that the claims extinguished if it wasn't brought within a year after the transfer occurred. And these are all items that are kept in, that are outlined in the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. And Judge Miller, writing his brief, he didn't touch on either one of those issues.
Did you raise them in the trial court?
Your Honor, we argued the entire defenses of the fraudulent transfer statute.
I understand.
I can't tell you today whether or not we made that specific argument concerned. We did concern the business transactions and the business, the regularly conducted business, but Your Honor, I didn't cite to it in the brief. Those are two important elements, though, that further support and bolster, one, Judge Miller's decision, but also the policy and procedure and what the whole concept of the Fraudulent Transfer Act is all about. The goal of the Fraudulent Transfer Act is to keep people from giving away their assets to avoid the claims of creditors, or doing something to actively avoid the payment of a creditor's claims. And that's just not the case here and never was. That claim of Nolte's was a disputed debt. And when Mr. Kaler left, he never thought for a minute there was any question as to whether or not that debt would be paid. He thought there was a dispute, the new owners disputed it, Mr. Schoniger disputed it, it wasn't his issue. He was able to leave, there was nothing he could do. He couldn't put this, there's no case law to support some kind of an escrow that Mr. Kaler was obligated to set up. He could have left money in there, but once he left, there's nothing he could have done to control whether that money stayed in Zephyr or not. That was all Schoniger's dealings. And it was up then, that fight between Zephyr and Schoniger and Nolte in the years that followed. That's when that finally solidified. And by then, the worst financial crisis in global history occurred, wiped out Mr. Schoniger's fortunes. And all of a sudden, there's not enough money, or for whatever reason, Mr. Schoniger and Zephyr isn't paying Mr. Kaler. There's just nothing Mr. Kaler could have done. And that isn't the kind of situation that either the breach of fiduciary duty claim or the Fraudulent Transfer Act is designed or intended in any way to protect. And what's most important here, Your Honor, is the fact that if you look at this order from Judge Miller, it is a well thought out, well reasoned, extensive order where he carefully evaluated the facts. He got them right. He's sitting there for 2 days and is able to pick up all of that, carefully evaluates it, balances everything, evaluates the facts, and makes decisions based on the Fraudulent Transfer Act and on the breach of fiduciary duty, and found in Mr. Kaler's favor. There's no abuse of discretion here. The facts, the records support his decision. And the fact is that there's really no question that what Mr. Kaler gave was reasonably equivalent value for the debt. He had a contract that said paying $540,000, they paid that $540,000. The second point is, there's nothing he did. He didn't prefer his debt over Nolte's. That debt was in dispute. He didn't do anything that kept Nolte from getting paid. And for those reasons, this court, we believe, needs to affirm Judge Miller's, the trial court's decision. And affirm that decision. Thank you.
Counsel, two additional sites were brought to our attention. Would you like to submit a brief on those sites, whether they apply or not, in your opinion?
I would not. I think I would stand on the ordinary presumption that if they weren't raised in the trial court and not mentioned in the brief, they're waived.
Okay.
The Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act absolutely contemplates circumstances where people can't do anything about it. I think it's clear from the statutes that it will, in fact, reach back and undo transfers when the creditors in question weren't actually creditors at the time of the transfers. But importantly, for the sake of this argument, forget reasonably equivalent value. Look at 38.8.106.2, which deals with transfers to insiders like Mr. Kaler. It essentially says that if our claim arose before the transfer is made to an insider, which Mr. Kaler was, and the insider had reasonable cause to believe that the debtor was insolvent, it's a fraudulent transfer. Don't even look at reasonably equivalent value. Obviously Mr. Kaler had a reason to believe that this company was insolvent.
Wasn't there evidence that suggested that Kaler believed that Schoniger paid Zephyr's bills as they became due?
Yeah, I don't think that matters, Judge.
Well, let me ask you, wasn't there evidence also that at the time that Schoniger paid Zephyr to pay Kaler, there looked to be enough money somewhere in Schoniger's accounts to pay those bills?
Yes, Your Honor. I think to take that argument to an illogical conclusion, you could also say that because Schoninger's mother had a tremendous amount of money and was interested in keeping her son out of trouble, she would have paid it too. It doesn't matter that somebody else had the money. All that matters is that Zephyr had the money. The only company you have to look at, need to look at, is Zephyr. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. Be in short recess.
Court will be in recess, subject to...